Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
Uh-huh.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Feed the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and
adult themes.
But, like, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
G'day everyone, this is B. Jabide, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the long-awaited episode 168 of the Super Podcast, the flagship show of the Super Network and supermarcy.com. And with me, as always, is the head honcho of supermarcy.com, and as well as the creator of all these shows that you hear on the Super Network, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hello, hello. That felt like a very grand introduction. So thank you very much for that. And I'm very happy to be back on the flagship show. It has been a while, but hopefully in 2025, we will have more episodes with all sorts of different movie discussions.
Indeed, indeed. And the last time we did a regular Super Podcast episode was a movie swap episode that we did with our good friend Buddy Watson. So shout out to Buddy if you're listening right now. And I'm very excited for this episode in particular because we have a really good fun topic to discuss. And with us is a man who has been on many episodes of this very show and as well as our other countless podcasts on the network. And he's also my co-host of the brand new podcast, Beat and Sam versus the Video Nasties. And that, of course, is Sam Inglis. Hello, Sam, and welcome back to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me again.
Well, we're glad that you're back on the Super Podcast, Sam. It has been a while, at least for this show in particular.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And for this episode of the show, we're going to be talking about our top five favorite discoveries of 2024. Now, everyone's already got their best of lists out from last year, but everybody's kind of got similar movies and whatnot on those lists. We want to do something a little bit different because the three of us love to watch all things of cinema from different periods of history and movies that we have never seen before. So we thought we would do a countdown of our top five favorite first-time watches or discoveries that we saw throughout 2024.
I will say, B, this isn't a sort of strictly a top five for me. Mm-hmm. It's more of like five representative, really interesting movies, but do them in alphabetical order that I have saved for last, what I think is probably my favorite discovery of last year. So
indeed.
Yeah, and I will do the same as Sam because I think I have like one that's a definitive, like, yep, that was the one. But yeah, the other ones I've picked, I think, be interesting to chat about. And yeah, so they will also be alphabetically.
Indeed, indeed. Now, before we actually go into the five films that we have picked for this episode, we also do have some honorable mentions. So we have picked three from last year that we felt didn't quite make our personal top fives, but were still pretty strong movies on their own. So, Marcy, tell us, what are your three honorable mentions of discoveries that you saw last year?
Yeah, so I just went with three that really stood out to me, and I think they could have possibly made the list as well because I think they're all interesting films. The first one I want to highlight is Black Belt Jones, which I saw as part of Junesploitation. And I feel like it was a crime that I hadn't seen it before, considering I've even met its star, Jim Kelly. And I just thought it was a great martial arts movie. It was an enjoyable drama. There was all sorts of stuff. And I have to highlight, there is a fight scene in a car wash and it's just amazing. So that one I definitely recommend people check out. Yeah, the second film I want to highlight, which I also watched for Junesploitation, is Lucio Fulci's Four of the Apocalypse, which is spaghetti western. And again, being more familiar with Fulci's horror work and wanting to kind of see more of him doing other genres, this one really took me by surprise. And in the end, it turned out to be quite an emotional experience. So it's another one I would recommend. I thought I would throw in an Ozploitation film with The Survivor, and it was one that we covered on the Ozploit cast. I think I'm one of this film's biggest fans. I watched it for the podcast. I was just captivated by it. I am actually keen to give it a rewatch, but I'd be curious if people have seen it, what they think. So yeah, they're my three honorable mentions.
Well, I think that it's a pretty solid selection of honorable mentions for the Umasi. And I got to say, though, with Four of the Apocalypse, because I did see it not last year, but the year before, I never thought in a million years I would see a Lucio Fulci film that would make me misty-eyed while watching it. And that movie managed to do that, surprisingly.
Yeah, it's
still some pretty gnarly violence in it, though, to be fair.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
There is.
Yeah, Four of the Apocalypse is the only one of those that I've seen that obviously is a martial arts movie fan, that should be stressed, rather than someone who does any. I need to see Black Belt Jones as well, and I need to get on another Ozploit cast so I can have an excuse to watch some more stuff from that end. But I'll definitely look into The Survivor as well, because I've seen some shit for the Ozploit cast, don't get me wrong, but I've also seen some really good movies.
So, Sam, tell us your three honorable mentions from last year.
So, first up, I've got, and I'll do these alphabetically as well, The Goddess, which is a 1934 Chinese silent film starring an actress named Ruan Lingyu. Pardon any foreign pronunciations that I may get wrong throughout this podcast, please. But basically, she plays a prostitute who is also a single mother and who gets swept up in a marriage to a degenerate gambler, but tries to leave him to try and earn an honest living and put her son into school. But when her husband finds her again and forces her back into prostitution, her son is ejected from school and ostracized. And it's very much a melodrama, and it's a silent film, so it's quite big in terms of the acting, or a lot of the acting anyway. But Ruan Lingyu is actually remarkably subtle and detailed and modern in her performance style. But maybe the most interesting thing about this film is, aside from just how good it is, it was Ruan Lingyu's final film. She passed away of suicide at age only 25. And you can see recreations of elements of this film in a film called Center Stage, starring Maggie Cheung, who plays Ruan Lingyu in that film. I think Center Stage is the best film of the 90s. And the best performance Maggie's ever given. So you should see both of those films and maybe even double bill them. Next up, Rouge, a 1987 film by Stanley Kwan. It's a sort of romantic ghost story starring Anita Moy about a courtesan, similarly, who falls in love with somebody who is above her station. And there's quite a few themes running through this. There's a suicide pact between them. But when she returns as a ghost 50 years later to contemporary Hong Kong, or then contemporary Hong Kong, she is searching for this man who was meant to die in the suicide pact with her. So they've been united forever, but she's never been able to find him. Anita Moy is absolutely incandescent in it, and it's a brilliant, brilliant film. Criterion have put it out in the US, and 88 Films are about to do an edition of it, as well as an edition of Center Stage in the UK. And finally, in a very drastic tone change, 1990 Greek film Singapore Sling, which anticipates the Greek weird wave by a good two decades and outdoes pretty much all of it in terms of extremity and disturbing content. It's almost noir styled at times. There's elements of Laura actually sort of seep into it, but it's this mother and daughter who capture and imprison a guy who comes to the house one day and essentially torture him quite a lot in manners both violent and sexual. It's incredibly extreme, one of the most outre performances I've ever seen. The sort of weird match of sometimes noirish stylization with this incredibly extreme content, which even today, as I say, even among like the Greek weird wave stuff, is still like notably tough to watch at times. If you are not fond of bodily fluids on film, even beyond blood, this is not a movie for you. Yeah, it's a challenging watch even now. And I got the Vinegar Syndrome edition a little while ago, having wanted to see it for ages. And yeah, it's a tough watch, but it does not disappoint. You'll never see anything quite like it.
Well, I'll go into my three honorable mentions for this episode. I would say first up is a film that actually the three of us discussed in 2024 on your solo show, Marcy, After Dark, where we discussed the film Thriller, A Cruel Picture. I thought that was a great rape revenge exploitation film. I mean, well, you could hear more of my thoughts on that film on that episode, but I think it's definitely a film that has really stuck with me since watching it last year. And also Christina Lindbergh's performance is fantastic. And yeah, it definitely lives up to its reputation as being one of the high marks in 70s exploitation cinema. And if people haven't seen it, definitely seek it out. Moving on is another film that is one that we talked about on our last Super Podcast episode, which was the Movie Swap episode, which of course was the Japanese film The Twilight Samurai, which is this great film about this samurai who's in kind of the twilight years of his life and wants to kind of settle down, especially now that he is a widower, to take care of his daughters and his mother, who is starting to go senile. But his past does come back to him. And the film stars Hiroyuki Sanada, who's one of those Japanese actors who's been in so many things, either in Japanese cinema or American cinema, but he's kind of really blown up in the West in the past year due to his Emmy Award-winning role in the TV show Shogun. So he's absolutely fantastic in this film. And it's definitely one that if you haven't seen The Twilight Samurai, it's definitely worth seeking out. And then, of course, finally, which I know you both were very surprised, I didn't pick it as one of my five films to discuss for this episode, is another Japanese film that we also talked about, Marcy, on that same Movie Swap episode, which of course was the 2010 film Confessions, which is a movie that you think you know where it's going in the first 20 minutes, and then every few minutes after that it just escalates from there in terms of where it goes with its story, and it provides twist after twist after twist. And then kind of the amazing thing too is the first 30 minutes of that film could easily be just a great short film, but the filmmakers just go further with that plot, and it just ends up being this kind of fantastic thriller. And I don't want to say too much about it, because obviously our listeners would have heard that episode and us going into a big discussion on it. But also it's one that definitely go into it as blind as possible, because believe me, it's one of those films like you're going to be absolutely surprised of the many twists and turns in that film.
It's that escalated quickly, the movie, and it's 5 stars. It just blew my mind, honestly. It really did.
I've got to say, I'm a little annoyed it took an actual movie swap to get you guys to watch Confessions, because I think I've been recommending it since I saw it in 2011 when it came out. You should listen to me more.
Well, to be fair, Seb, I had other movies I needed to watch that were very high priority to me, like Cool as Ice, starring Vanilla Ice. Those are the movies I needed to see first before I saw Confessions.
The thing that's, I mean, all of Confessions is memorable. It's astonishing. I love the score, which is there's use of the Japanese noise band Boris, some Radiohead in there, which is maybe the only time I've enjoyed Radiohead. But the thing that really sort of smacks you in the face about it, I think, is the ending. I remember I saw it twice at the cinema here when it came out. And most times you go to the cinema and the credits start rolling and everyone's on their feet and heading for the door immediately. Both times I saw it, no fucker moved during the credits. It just sort of poleaxes you at the end. It really does. It's an incredible film. Actually, all of Tetsuya Nakashima's first 3 films, I didn't like World of Kaneko, which was the follow-up to this. But his first 3, Kamikaze Girls, Memories of Matsuko, and this are all well worth seeing.
I'll make sure to put those on the list to check out for sure.
Yeah. And I've got to say, given that I had 2 in the honorable mentions, we've just talked about Confessions, and I've got a bunch more to come. We're going to be talking about a lot of Asian cinema today. I had a big Asian cinema year in 2024, and it worked out quite nicely.
Definitely. So we might as well get straight to it. Now, Marcy, which film from your list would you like to talk about that was one of your 5 favorite discoveries from last year?
Yeah, so I'm going alphabetically. And the first film up for me that I just really, really liked and sounded really, really interesting and different was I'm Your Man from 2021. And it just so happens to star my beloved Dan Stevens. So it felt criminal not including a film with him on the list, considering I did watch quite a few new-to-me Dan Stevens films. But I think this one was one of the more interesting, as it's about a woman who is like participating in a study sort of thing, and she's writing about it, and it's about sort of being with a humanoid robot that is tailored to be everything she wants, and that robot happens to look like Dan Stevens. And it goes into interesting themes about loneliness and loss, and I really just thought that the Dan Stevens, obviously, I think he was fantastic, but Maren Egert as Alma, I just thought was really, really fantastic. And she, I could feel a lot of what she was going through in certain scenes, but I just thought it was really well done and really thought provoking. And I think director Maria Schrader made a really interesting and intriguing film. And I'm very glad that I did see it, because it sort of, it threw me a bit. Not with things that I was not expecting. So that's my first pick.
So I haven't seen this, but I like Dan Stevens exclusively when he's a fucking weirdo. He's one of our best fucking weirdos in movies right now. Abigail and Cuckoo last year were both sort of fine overall, but Dan Stevens being a weird, threatening, twitchy, amoral bastard is kind of my vibe in terms of how he works as an actor. Not really interested in him in Downton Abbey mode. Who cares? But yeah, weird little German accented freak. Absolutely, bring it on.
Yeah, I mean, I call it the Dan Stevens sex robot, but he just plays this. He plays it like he is this android, but there's just something else to it that I just found fascinating with how he tackled it. And I was not complaining about the German. I could kind of hear his accent in the way of speaking German, and they address it in the film as part of what the main character of Alma is attracted to. And I thought these little bits just ended up being quite clever and interesting. And it made me think, like, if I was given something for them to give me, like, my perfect partner, would I just end up with a Dan Stevens sex robot?
Most likely, yes, Marcy.
And I'll give my ratings for everything, but I gave this 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed the movie as well, and I think it's kind of an interesting kind of take on the romance film, because it does mix in a bit of comedy, a bit of sci-fi, and you're right, Maren Egert, I think, is great as well, and she has great chemistry with Dan Stevens, and he does play a robot really well, and he just knows how to project so much charm from him, but also you get that sort of artificial feeling from him as well.
I think that's what I was trying to articulate before. Yeah.
And also, one thing I was very surprised about, it was like his very, because I, from based on what I've read, Dan Stevens is very fluent in German. So I was very surprised on how well he did with doing the German language in this film.
Yeah, as I say, I've got to see this yet, but I've enjoyed other stuff that Maren Egert has worked on as an actor, and I've been interested in this. I just haven't got around to it yet. So, yeah, definitely on the list.
And Sam, what's your first film you would like to talk about?
Yeah, so my first film is Death Game, which was actually made and finished in 1974, but not released until 1977. It sounds like it was an absolute nightmare to make. Fights on the set, Seymour Cassell, who plays the lead, almost punching out the director, having an absolutely horrific time during some of the scenes in which Sandra Locke and Colleen Camp, who play two beautiful young women who turn up at his doorstep one night while his wife is away, to go and look after their son who's been taken ill while he's been staying with his grandmother. They turn up at his house drenched from the rain and ask if they can use the phone. And that then turns into first a night of, well, not passion, but sex. Then the women sort of taking over the house and eventually tying up George, the guy, and putting him on trial for perceived slights against man and perhaps more pivotally womankind. If you listen to that synopsis, and you won't be surprised to know, was a big influence on Eli Roth's Knock Knock, which is, I think, is a deeply inferior film because it's fucking Eli Roth. Of course it is. But I think what makes this one work for me is the madness of Sandra Locke and Colleen Camp's performances. You just cannot predict what they're going to do next, from the way they're going to look from scene to scene to just their behavior. And it always keeps you on edge. The politics, you know, it's a 70s exploitation film. It's all a little sticky. There's an interesting take on feminism sort of buried in there, but it is perhaps not the most consistent film politically, particularly in how it is often exploitative of Camp and Locke being naked. But what it sort of made me think of, particularly with its repeated dinner sequences and things like that, was sequences from Vera Chitilova's Daisies, if Daisies had been directed by somebody less politically astute and more attuned to exploitation cinema. And I can't think of a much higher recommendation than that. By the way, I love Daisies. I think it's an incredible film. I don't mean to denigrate it in any way by associating it with this rather grubby one. But as I say, I think I'm actually older now than Seymour Cassell was when he made this film, which disturbs me. But I think looking at it from that point of view, you would be hard-pressed not to understand why he lets them in.
Yeah.
And why things begin to go off the rails from there. I just think it's a great sort of freewheeling, extremely entertaining, if, as I say, somewhat inconsistent politically, exploitation movie. My only real issue with it is the ending is absolutely arbitrary and just feels like they just couldn't think of anything else. But yeah, it's a manic minor classic, I think, of exploitation cinema. Mm.
I agree. I, for the record, if I hadn't seen a movie that you used to have picked, I ended up watching it. So I did watch this and I agree. And I have added Daisies to my watch list because I'm very intrigued to see it after watching Death Game. But
yeah, it's not that close, but certain elements.
Yeah. But I don't know. I love my weird and maniacal exploitation, and this was right up there, and the two leads are just so great.
Sandra Locke looks so incredible in that top hat and makeup. If ever there was a female Joker, you know, I think
I'd buy
Sandra
that.
Locke in the second half of this is my pick for the female Joker.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought they both were great, and yeah, if you love your exploitation and haven't seen this one, put it to the top of your pile because it is well worth it.
Well, I haven't watched the Death Game yet. I was umming and ahhing whether to watch it in prep for the show because I actually do own the Blu-ray of it. But I had my heart set on it for 31 Days of Horror this year.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So I decided to save it for them. But Marcy, you know me, I like to go down the rabbit hole when it comes to certain things about this film because I was doing research on this film. The film was shot by David Wirth. Would you like to know what else he has done, Marcy? Mm-hmm. He was the cinematographer on Bloodsport.
Oh.
And he would be a director in his own right. He directed Kickboxer.
Oh, and I should have even known that, right?
But Marcy, he is the director of Shark Attack 3 Megalodon.
Oh, no shit. Okay. How did I never put those pieces together? I must be a fucking idiot.
Well, I'm just as shocked about it as you, like, looking through it. Because I love doing deep dives in film, in people's filmography. So I'm just about as blown away by this as you are.
Well, Bede, what is your fifth film that you have picked?
Well, I think for my five films I wanted to discuss for this episode, I really wanted to kind of have a bit of variety of different films. So for my very first one, I thought, you know what? I want to pick a documentary for this episode. And the one I picked was the 2016 documentary One More Time with Feeling, which was directed by Australian director Andrew Dominic. And it is a documentary about the band Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds recording their 16th studio album, Skeleton Tree. So you think, okay, it's just your behind the scenes type of documentary on the making of an album. But the thing is, though, what makes this documentary so fantastic is they filmed this not long after when one of Nick Cave's sons accidentally died. So this documentary is kind of seeing this man coming to terms with his loss and his grief and how it affects his performance on recording these songs for the album. Like, you will listen to the songs themselves, you think, oh, Nick Cave must have wrote a lot of these songs about what happened to his son. But the thing is, all these songs were actually already written beforehand. So now he's had this kind of horrific experience happened to him. It really goes into how he uses his grief to put into his art, and seeing him perform all these songs from the album, which, having listened to the album myself, and I'm a huge fan of this album, it is listening and watching him perform, like, you can see the anguish that he is going through recording a lot of these songs, particularly with certain ones. One song in particular that you could just almost see he's about to break is a song called I Need You. And it's a beautiful film. Like, it's shot in black and white, where you do get interviews with Nick Cave, but you also get interviews with his other band members like Warren Ellis, and also his wife and other son are also in the documentary as well, and they talk. But it really is a documentary about a man coming to terms with his grief and how he projects it into his art. And it is a very emotional experience. And I know the film is also shot for 3D, which is kind of surprising, but when you kind of see the actual songs being performed live, you could see why they went for that sort of 3D effect, particularly during one song in particular called Distant Sky, which is also another one. It really hits home because how Nick Cave sings it, it feels very personal as well. I just found this such a great documentary. So if people who love music documentaries, I'd say definitely check out One More Time with Feeling. It's a really, really top-notch one.
Yeah, it's not a typical sort of music documentary either. It's visually, it's absolutely beautiful. Because of what the subject matter is and it's dealing with grief, I kind of walked away from it like, I feel like I have a hell of a lot of grief that I haven't dealt with. So it hits you in the feeling. It really does. But yeah, it's done in a interesting way. And yeah, as you see him sort of perform the songs, you see it in there. So yeah, something very, very different.
It kind of amazes me because I haven't seen the film, but I have heard the album. And it kind of amazes me that I think all or certainly the bulk of the record was actually written before his son passed away. And there it becomes a conversation about how what we know about an artist inevitably comes to play into how we interpret their art and whether that's organic or not. Because you can't listen to that record and not hear a man absolutely broken by grief. And you can't read the lyrics and not see it in the lyrics. And yet those lyrics were written before it happened. And you have to ask whether you're reading that in because of what, or that would have been how this album felt regardless. You can't answer that question because what happened happened. So I'm interested to see the film and see how that sort of plays in as a dynamic, whether it's discussed in the interviews and whether directly or somewhat more obliquely than I've just put it. But I think that's the thing about that particular Bad Seeds record that it will never get away from. Yeah, it's a fascinating, beautiful, heartbreaking record. I love Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I just, as I say, haven't got to this.
You sort of need to be prepared. I was not prepared.
I've cried at Nick Cave's songs that aren't particularly sad. I mean, the ship song just destroys me every time. It's one of my favorite songs.
I definitely was watching a lot of this, wiping away just tears with just the emotion that it brings as a film, as a portrait of grief, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm also particularly want to check out, I guess, the companion piece documentary that Nick Cave and Andrew Dominik made a few years later called This Much I Know to Be True, which is kind of more of the process between Nick Cave and his bandmate Warren Ellis recording the follow-up Nick Bad Seeds album Ghosteen and also their duo album together Carnage. But I know with Ghosteen, that was the album he wrote especially about what happened to his son and also kind of coming to terms with it as well. So I'm kind of curious just to see that documentary as well and seeing how it compares to One More Time with Feeling. But Marcy, what is your second pick you would like to discuss?
Yeah, the next film that I picked to discuss is 1978's Magic, which was directed by Richard Attenborough, and it stars Anthony Hopkins, Anne Margaret, Burgess Meredith, and Ed Lauder. I always get the name wrong. And I ended up watching this because we did an episode of Podcasters of Horror where we discussed the episode called The Dummy. And our guest, Tony Meekus, who you can check out at Imprintcast, made mention of magic and just sort of talking about he loves sort of ventriloquism films and had made mention of this. And I was very intrigued, especially with it being a Richard Attenborough film and starring Anthony Hopkins. And yeah, this one is something else. Like, Anthony Hopkins' performance is incredible. And he's a ventriloquist, and you're sort of left to wonder whether this dummy is like really alive or it's being controlled or if it's just all Anthony Hopkins' character. And there's romance thrown in there as well. There's quite a bit going on, but I just found this really just fascinating, really well done. And it's one of those films where you see a lot of different sides to the performance from Anthony Hopkins, but it's also like you feel sympathy for him, but you're not quite sure. But I just found it such an intriguing and interesting film, and it's one I'm glad I saw, and it's one that I now own physically. It felt like it was just looking at me at our dear friend Lee Gambin's treasure sale. So RIP Lee, and yeah, I'm glad I own this movie because it was staring at me from your collection. And I do believe he made mention of it when I posted I was watching it. So I think it's a little bit special and something that now will kind of remind me of a dearly departed friend.
I mean, I've seen Magic as well. I watched it for 31 Days of Horror a few years ago, and I have to agree, I do think it is a great psychological horror film about Anthony Hopkins' character and whether his relationship with his dummy, which he also voices as well, whether everything is happening or not. And it's a really compelling one, and it also feels like an outlier in Richard Attenborough's filmography, because this is a guy, I mean, who, other than also being best known for his role in Jurassic Park, but more like if you compare his other films, they're all sort of like big prestige films. And there's this like this little psychological horror film kind of nudged in between there. And I think he does a really great job with this film and finds a good balance of the film's psychological elements. And also it probably helps that it's from a screenplay by William Goldman, which is based on his own book as well. And having the combination of these two men, along with Anthony Hopkins and the rest of the cast, they deliver a pretty strong, compelling film.
And the dummy, I find the ventriloquist dummies are generally just quite unsettling. And this one is very unsettling to look at. But yeah, I just was kind of like, I had no idea what I was in for, and I just thought, wow.
Yeah, ventriloquist dummies that try to look human are just wrong. I think Magic trades pretty well off that. And yeah, as you guys say, Hopkins is terrific in it. I was just checking, I didn't watch it for my Shocktober viewing, but yeah, I saw it a few years back. I haven't revisited, but I should do. But yeah, there's a lot to like here, and you're right. It is a sort of weird thing for maybe Richard Attenborough to have directed. But yeah, he gets a lot of creep factor into it, particularly thanks to Hopkins. Yeah, good solid movie. And yeah, I stand by, like I say, the ventriloquist dummies, the ones that try to look human. Not right.
Nope, not right. They're creepy.
Agreed. And Sam, what is your second pick?
Yeah, so next on my list is a Japanese film from 1964 called The Shape of Night, directed by Noboru Nakamura. And it's basically about a woman named Yoshie, played by Miyuki Kuwano, who begins dating an older man. She doesn't know initially that he's a low-ranking yakuza, and he, quite quickly after they get into a relationship, forces her into prostitution. And we watch the story of her life with him in kind of two timelines. as she's relating it 6 years later across a series of meetings with another man named Fuji, who has kind of become more than just a client, or would like to be more than just a client. What's interesting is, like, in 1964, we wouldn't have been able to say this, but the language wasn't really there. But I think it's really a movie about coercive control and the push and pull of trying to leave a coercively controlling relationship, both for Yoshie, who sort of stays with Eiji for the good times and sort of adjusts to the bad times, I think, and is more settled once he is attacked and stabbed in the leg and actually loses his sexual function, which sort of removes a lot of threatening elements from their relationship in a way. But I also think it's about a coercively controlling relationship to some degree in terms of Eiji, the Yakuza, who is being controlled by the gang and made to put his girlfriend in this position of becoming a prostitute to make sure he's paying the money that he needs to the gang each week, each month. That's no excuse for him, obviously, but it is certainly a similar dynamic in an interesting way. And I think the film, as I say, without having the language that we have now, draws the parallels between those two relationships quite interestingly. It's also an incredibly beautiful film for a film about such ugliness. It's so gorgeously shot, lit with strips of neon a lot of the time in sort of mid-60s Tokyo. So it's sort of in this state between the urbanized megalopolis that we see now and the rural Japan of years and years past. So Tokyo is in this sort of transitional period, it feels like to me, from the visuals here anyway. I don't know my Japanese history if I'm off base on that, but that's just what the visuals were giving me. The visuals were also giving me Wong Kar-wai, specifically in The Mood for Love. I think if you look at this, I can't imagine that it wasn't a huge visual and somewhat tonal influence on In the Mood for Love. It is not a romantic film in the way that In the Mood for Love is. I think even at the end, the choices that are made, however freeing or not they might be, are not ones that are romanticized or could be. But I think it's incredibly acted, particularly by Miyuki Kuwano as Yoshie. This sort of push and pull of a single moment, whether she loves Eiji or hates him. And the answer to both of those things is yes. And we can often see that sort of running through her mind within a very short sequence, particularly towards the end of the film and the sort of denouement. Yeah, I think it's an incredible film. And anyone who's at all interested in Japanese cinema or particularly Wong Kar-wai, Chinese cinema, should be looking into this.
Yeah, having now watched it, I echo those sentiments. It's incredibly beautiful, as you said, for such ugliness. It's visually such an interesting and striking film. And yeah, it seems of that coercive control and how they parallel each other through those two characters, I think, done really, really well. And it's done in an interesting way that it's not overtly obvious, but it's definitely there. And yeah, the performances, I think, are just on another level. And I was thinking about rewatching In the Mood for Love, and then we were doing this and reminded of that. I'm like, yeah, I really need to revisit that again. But yeah, they do have similar sort of with the neon and the tone, but yeah, very two very different films. But yeah,
I think the costuming is parallel as well between those two films, and the precision of the costuming as much as anything.
So that's one I will definitely be revisiting as well. But yeah, this one just kind of blew me away.
Yeah, I have to agree as well. I did watch it in prep for this episode, and I wasn't sure what to expect. But it's funny though, even before you said the Wong Kar-wai comparison, Sam, like, I got that a lot immediately from this film, from both the visuals and the tone. But I think one of the things that kind of really struck me about this film is Like, I just couldn't believe that this was a film that came out in 1964. It feels like a film that would have came out in the middle, late 80s. That's what it kind of just felt like to me watching this one, because it didn't feel like a 60s film at all. Like, it felt very modern in terms of how it was made and presented. And could also be that the neon drenched visuals may have also factored into that as well. But I just think it's a very sublimely made film, and it is very heartbreaking as well. The performances are just fantastic. And yeah, this one was a major surprise. So I'm happy that this came to my attention.
I really need to start looking into the more of Nakamura's filmography as well.
Mm. Well, I'll move on to my second pick for this show. And it's, I thought, you know what, I need to go with something crime related. So I went with the 1980 Lucio Fulci film Contraband, which I watched earlier last year for Junesploitation. And this is a film that follows two brothers who live in Naples, and they, for their work, they smuggle cigarettes. And of course, they always try to make sure that the police are never on their trail. But over the course of the story, they find themselves in between two crime bosses after they lose a load of cigarettes. And of course, the sort of the violence and repercussions just come from there. I found this a very compelling film. I love a good crime story, so this one was definitely right up my alley. And surprisingly, a lot of Fulci's trademark violence is very prevalent in this film. Like, you wouldn't expect it in a film like this, but yeah, there's a lot of gory moments sprinkled throughout. But how he sort of presents it, though, he doesn't really kind of linger on him like he does in his horror films. Like, this is like fast and quick type of violence. And it kind of just comes in bursts, which I think really adds to the intensity of the film. But I think the performances are great. I think it's really well directed from Fulci. And it's kind of interesting, like, looking at Fulci's work outside of the horror genre and seeing what he has done. Because again, we talked about Four of the Apocalypse before, so seeing a spaghetti western from him. And I know even before he stuck closely to horror films, he directed a wide variety of different genres, including comedies. So I'm very curious to kind of see the other work he's done, because I was very impressed by Contraband. I just found this such a riveting film from beginning to end.
Yeah. I watched this, I think, maybe 2023 or 2022. I can't remember. It was a Junesploitation. And again, an excuse to see a non-horror Fulci film. And yeah, I was just really impressed. It feels like a Fulci film, but it's so different to the other films of his that I've seen. And I thought it was really compelling. And I really enjoyed the performances as well. But yeah, I just thought this was quite a compelling film. And I'm really still, like, obviously, Junesploitation I use as a good excuse to see different sides of Fulci, so I'm very keen for that to happen again this year and see more.
Yeah, I haven't got to this one. It was one that I was going to try and watch for the show, except that so much of Fulci's stuff has now come out here and has got decent releases, and this is one of the ones that I've really been wanting to see for ages and ages, and I didn't really want to sort of dig up a half-assed copy on the internet just to watch and then have it announced 3 months later for a spanking new Blu-ray or something. I would rather see it in as good condition as I can when I first see it. And I think this is one that's going to be worth waiting for rather than compromising on quality on it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I would say once it does get released in the UK, say I'm definitely seek it out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't have any inside knowledge, just as a disclaimer, but I can see somebody like 88 or Arrow or a company like that picking it up and doing something fairly special with it. So fingers crossed for that. And Yeah, I mean, otherwise, I'm sure there's a Blu-ray I can import at some point, but I just haven't got around to that yet. So, but yeah, it's very much high up on my list.
And Marcy, what is your third pick for the episode?
Yeah, so I decided to go with The Night Porter from Liliana Cavani with Charlotte Rampling. And I think the fact that it was Charlotte Rampling was one of the things that I was like, okay, yeah. But this has always come up on just a lot of sort of lists and things. And it's like, okay, maybe I'll just get to it. And strangely enough, it's on Tubi. Tubi has a bit of everything. That's why we love a free streaming service. Yeah, this is a film about, don't want to use the word, but I'm going to have to. It deals with former Nazis and survivors of that. And
yeah, why would you want to use the word Nazi at the moment? It's not like it's at all relevant.
No, not at all. But yeah, the film sort of sees two people from back in the war sort of reconnect, but the reconnecting is that, like,
he was a concentration camp officer, wasn't he?
I believe so, yes.
And she was a prisoner.
Yes. So their relationship during, because we see the flashbacks, I guess it would be a sadomasochistic relationship. And I think the only words I could write after watching this film was that it felt like it was a trauma bonding, the movie, but trauma bonding in the worst possible way. But I don't know, something just struck me as really interesting and different and tackling themes and different situations, I suppose, that hadn't really been explored. It's not the kind of Nazi exploitation that you two will end up getting to on the Video Nasties. This one, I think, has something to say, and I think it's quite an interesting film, but I still don't have the words. It's one of these films where it's like, I'm putting it on here, I'm going to try to talk about it, but it's just, it's hard to have the words with how I just felt about this film.
I think what's interesting about it is, you say it's not the kind of Nazi exploitation that we're covering, and unfortunately have already recorded some of that coverage. I think that's our next episode going up, isn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah, won't that be fun? I think the interesting thing is it kind of invented those films by accident in some ways, though I'm not sure about the timing of this and Ilsa. I think they're pretty close. But anyway, definitely, I think The Night Porter, if The Night Porter doesn't exist, that genre doesn't exist in the same way, certainly. I wasn't a big fan of it. I mean, it is justly iconic. The famous sequence with Charlotte Rampling in her suspenders is obviously as thorny and interesting as anything in 70s cinema. It's really disturbing in some interesting ways. And I think the whole film, you can say that of. I think the problem for me, the reason I didn't really click in with it, maybe it caught me on the wrong day. I think this is definitely a film that, as somebody who loves exploitation, it definitely is influential on exploitation, but is a much more meditative film than that. So maybe I wasn't quite prepped for that. And also, the DVD copy I had was absolute dog shit. So that didn't really help me. I swear they just slapped a VHS on a disc.
And I think, surprisingly, the copy on Tubi is not a VHS rip.
Oh, fair enough. But yeah, there's a Blu-ray here now, so I want to pick up a cleaned-up version and sort of go in more sort of prep for what kind of film it is and see where I land on it. But yeah, as I say, maybe it just caught me on the wrong day. These things with these themes, some days you're sort of ready to deal with that stuff, and some days you're just really not.
Well, I did watch it in prep for this episode, and I gotta say, I agree with you, Marcy. I was really caught off guard by this film. I thought it was terrific. And I guess when I went into it, like, when you had that setup of Dirk Bogarde and Charlotte Rampling's characters, him being a former Nazi guard and her being a prisoner at this concentration camp, and them kind of meeting for the first time, and especially now that he and his former cohorts are basically organizing the, and also preparing themselves for the trials that they're about to go under, I just thought, like, oh, okay, this is going to be a case where he runs into Charlotte Rampling and they see each other the first time, and you kind of think, is Charlotte Rampling gonna take revenge on Dirk Bogarde? But then when it kind of shifts gears in the halfway point, and you realize, oh, they actually had this sort of masochistic relationship with each other, that's where it kind of even elevated for me, because I was not expecting that direction and the sort of toxic relationship between the two of them. Which, when you kind of watch the film in the first half, you can definitely see he's basically controlling her and just making her his plaything. But then you realize, like, they actually do love each other. It's such a weird film in that way, but Sam's right in the way that I think I was not expecting it to be as meditative as it is, especially in the second half. And yeah, I just found it really captivating as a film.
Yeah, I agree.
And Sam, your third pick for the episode.
Yeah, my third pick is a French film from 1960 called Le Trou, The Hole. It's a film by a director named Jacques Becker, who I don't think I've seen anything else by. I'm just looking. Yeah, it was his last film, in fact. I do have Touche par un Grisby to watch, so I will have to get to that. But there's a really interesting little conceit at the very beginning of the film where you see somebody who turns out to be one of the characters that we follow introduce the film and say, "My friend Jacques Becker has made this film, and it's a faithful recreation of things that actually happened." How true that is, I'm not 100% sure. But it's a prison break film, essentially. It's about a young guy who is sent to prison on remand before he's tried for attempted murder of his wife. And how culpable he is for that is a little bit of a discussion during the film, but most of the film is centered on the fact that when he arrives in his cell, the other four men who are there are already some way to enacting a plan to escape. They all have at least 10 years on their sentences still to run, so there's not a whole lot for them to lose by trying to escape. And most of the film is the process of that and the process of trying to hide it, which they do with work that they are supposed to do, folding cardboard boxes for pennies, using the assembled and disassembled boxes to hide where the hole is being made to get them under the prison and into the sewers. Yeah, it's just like a lot of Prison Break films. I think it's just a great film about process and how that process is used to generate suspense. And there's some really clever ways of hiding the fact that two of them are out of their cell at any given time. The way they create a timing device is great and a really suspenseful sequence in and of itself, because they've got to steal a couple of bottles, getting caught with guards in the cell while they have to stand to hide the hole because they haven't had time to put the boxes back in place. And one fantastic suspense sequence where they have to get one of the pipes in their cell fixed. The plumbers, being fellow prisoners, are not particularly trustworthy. There's some really interesting sort of moral dilemma towards the end of the film that I won't spoil. But yeah, it's just a really beautifully shot as well. The sequences under the prison, when they first get under, there are these amazing sequences of them using a small candle to walk down these long hallways and disappearing into the blackness over and over again. And those sequences are stunningly shot. But using all of these bits of process to create suspense throughout, I think it's just masterfully done.
This film, I think, broke me a little bit. It was incredible. Incredible piece of just piece of film. I felt like I was going to have a panic attack, an anxiety attack, a heart attack while I'm watching this. And it's not like it's a fast moving film. It's the intensity of getting to know these characters, and their plan is very loud. And you're expecting that these guards are going to hear them and find them, and I'll be just waiting for some moment to happen as they do this. It's just so really well done. I just think maybe the guards may have been hard of hearing, but I think where the film goes, I don't want to spoil anything, but I honestly just blown away. It's incredible to look at. And as you said, those scenes sort of underneath when they sort of dig down, like they're so well shot and just, oh, I have so much praise for this film. I was not expecting what I got, and I love the fact that I got what I got, even though I'm still very much broken by the
Have
film.
You seen Bresson's A Man Escaped as well? That's another French prison break movie that is very, very good, very, very processed focused.
Yeah, you should
see. If you like this, you should see that.
Okay, I have to look it up.
Well, I did watch this one too in prep for the show, and I agree with Marcy. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I love a good prison film, particularly a prison escape film. And this one just really hit all those buttons for me. And I love the fact that it sort of plays it very low key in terms of its visual style, even though it does look fantastic.
I mean, how mesmerizing was it watching these men just hammer at cement and stuff?
Oh, yes.
I was transfixed by it. Incredible. Sorry to cut you off.
Well, the process of them trying to escape was fantastic. And I like the fact that there are moments where they just like lingered on certain scenes a little bit longer, whether they are cutting through a bar or a few other things as well. Like, I love that kind of stuff in there. And yeah, the ending itself is fantastic as well, which I won't give away. But yeah, it is a great ending and definitely up there as one of my favorite prison films. I was very surprised about this one.
Next one, B.
Well, I'm going to go into horror territory with my next pick. And that, of course, is the 1963 Brazilian horror film. In fact, the first Brazilian horror film ever made. And that, of course, is At Midnight, I Will Take Your Soul, which was directed by José Mojica Marins. And if I probably butchered his name, please forgive me. And this is actually the first installment of the Coffin Joe series. And Marins actually plays the main character in this film. Pretty much the plot summary for this film is that Coffin Joe is a gravedigger in this city, and he is an absolute bastard to everyone. He is.
That's an understatement.
Like, he is truly evil. Like, he is horrible to everyone. We kind of see him in his interactions with the people in this town, but also at the same time, he wants to find a woman to bear him a son. This one I've been hearing about for quite a long time, because knowing that it is the first Brazilian produced horror film, and it's also part of a big major franchise that's kind of one of the unsung villains in horror. So I was very much looking forward to watching this, and I did pick up the Coffin Joe box set from Arrows, because that's how I watched it for the first time. And this one in particular, I was enthralled by. And Coffin Joe, being that he's this undertaker who has disdain for religion, emotions, and just anything that is just good in this world, and he thinks he's so superior to everyone, and he is a complete asshole, and we kind of just see him just be this absolute monster to everyone throughout this film. And Marins, as a filmmaker, he does a really good job with this one, because the film does look great and it has a great bit of atmosphere, and also there's a bit of a gothic flavor to it as well. But even as a performer, he's just fantastic in the lead role. And this is one of those kind of stories where you're like, oh, you just can't wait for this guy to get his comeuppance at some point. And I won't spoil what happens, but it's definitely, I will say for myself, a very satisfying way. But yeah, I had a feeling I was going to enjoy this one, but I didn't expect to love it as much as I did. So yeah, this one is definitely one of my favorite older films that I watched from last year, and I can't wait to watch the rest of the Coffin Joe series.
I too am intrigued by seeing this Coffin Joe series, especially how this ends. But he is such a, I mean, look, the character of Coffin Joe is a C-U-N-T, like he really is. If you see this guy, you're like, what the fuck is he getting away with all this shit? It's infuriating, and it's meant to be infuriating. He's meant to be this kind of person. But I think around it as well, it's got a very cool sort of style and atmosphere, and you can see it is sort of quite cheap, but I think it adds to the sort of charm of the film. I like how it was paced, because I think it was paced really well. You sort of get enough each time, but yeah, I just wanted this guy to meet the worst kind of fate, because Coffin Joe is just an ass. He really is. But it's a really different and intriguing kind of film from the early 60s.
And it's not afraid to get dark, too. Like, there are some really horrific moments that Coffin Joe does to people in this film. Even I was sitting there going, like, I can't believe this, again, like you say, Marcy, is something that has happened in the early 60s. But then again, Sam and I recently covered Blood Feast for our podcast, and that movie is as gory as hell. So I shouldn't be surprised at this point.
that episode won't be out by the time this one is, I think.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, we have recorded it. It is coming.
Definitely. And Sam, have you seen At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul yet?
I haven't. I have the old DVD box set, and I keep meaning to just sit down and do the whole set. And I think that's why I didn't just do the one movie, because I just want to, like, blast them at some point. And maybe Shocktober will be the occasion to do that this year. We shall see. Depends what else is on the plate by then, I guess, and what else is coming out for Halloween and all that stuff. So we'll see. But yeah, obviously, Marins and Coffin Joe are, like, pivotal figures in world horror. So I've got to see it at some point. I just haven't got it.
I will say, just the frame of, like, Coffin Joe with his eyebrows and eyes, especially his freaky monobrow, it's burned into my brain. I feel like it's gonna give me nightmares. I just think he did such a great job with, like, crafting this just asshole character and the way he
that's was. Along with Death Game, a couple of films with incredibly overdone eyebrows in this selection of movies.
I mean, he also, Marcy, wears a cape and also a top hat as well, which is like, I think I should dress
also
up as Coffin.
Also Death Game.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, I should dress up as Coffin Joe for Halloween one year.
Actually, you could probably pull it off.
Definitely.
Just
definitely.
Don't pluck your eyebrows for a month. You'll be good.
Yeah, I don't think that'll be too hard. But Marcy, what is your fourth pick for the episode?
Yeah, so going back to the last episode of the Super Podcast where we did the movie swap, now going to mention third movie from that podcast. There were three movies and this was the
third. That one went well.
Yeah, so Bede gave this one to me. So it is the 2004 film, Yesterday, from South Africa. And this one was actually a HBO movie, I believe, Bede. Mm.
Well, technically, it was theatrically released, but it was picked up by HBO. Yeah. And what makes it interesting is it was nominated for both for a Best International Film Oscar and also a Best Outstanding TV Movie Emmy in the same
yes,
year.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And look, a film about a woman who finds out she has HIV/AIDS, and the outlook just doesn't look good. There's a lot of sadness going on. It's a film that you don't think is going to have a positive outlook or message, but it really does. I was so captured by the main character and her journey, and it's a big struggle of a journey, but it's the relationship between mother and daughter that is at the heart of the film, and that her goal is, while she does have this condition that she wasn't aware of, even the doctors have to explain it all to her, but she's got this positive outlook for giving her daughter a better life. And I just thought it was such a beautiful film, really just well done. in every way. It honestly, it's another one that just blew me away. And you can hear more of my thoughts on that podcast episode. But I just felt it was really worthy of mentioning again. I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful film.
Yeah, and it's definitely a film that I've been championing since I first saw it. And I think it's such a beautifully done film. And Laleti Kumalo, who plays Yesterday, gives such a beautiful performance. And like you say, Marcy, it is a story about the love between a mother for her daughter and wanting to make sure that even despite her illness, she wants to make sure that her daughter still has the best future and life. And again, Marcy, I got to bring this up because I brought it up on that episode too. It's hard to believe that this movie is from the same director who made Dracula 3000 and Lake Placid Legacy.
Yeah, that blows me away. This film is not at all like those.
Right now I'm fascinated.
But, oh my God, just incredible. Just such a beautiful film. Has this just beautiful outlook towards the end and just the strength of the character of Yesterday. Yeah, I love this. I just felt it was so worthy of bringing up again.
And also, too, it's the first commercially feature-length production done in Zulu.
Yes. Thank you.
I have to say, when I saw this on the list, I was like, the fucking The Beatles Disappeared movie? That was terrible. There was one good joke in that, and it was about Oasis being the only other band that disappeared, which is legit funny. Anyway, no, so fortunately it's not that. I confess I hadn't heard of this, and it sounds very interesting. I think, basically, I just need to see more African cinema as a whole. I've seen shamefully little. It's when you look at my Letterboxd stats, it's probably the biggest sort of dead spot on the world map. I've seen bits and pieces, but very little. And there are large spots of the continent where I've never seen a movie from that country. And I try to be somebody who, like when I was going to festivals and I was still going to the cinema, I had this philosophy of like, oh, there's a film from a country I've never seen a film from before. That's on my list by default. And I think that's probably how I've seen quite a lot of African cinema over the years. I need to be better about it. I need to dig in more. It probably needs to be a project. I've got several projects this year, so it won't be this year, but we'll see in the future. But yeah, I just need to do that as part of my education. I'm 43. I've been a film buff for 30 plus years. You never stop learning. You never stop needing to discover new stuff.
So, exactly. Yeah, this
is one that I've got to start digging.
And Sam, what's your fourth pick?
Yeah, keeping with the Asian cinema theme of my list, my fourth pick is When Taekwondo Strikes. It kind of does exactly what it says on the tin. This is the great Angela Mao Ying in a lead as a Chinese woman who becomes embroiled in the Korean resistance to Japanese occupiers, both in China and in Korea. And she ends up being teamed up with Jun Ri. This is his only film. He was the man who brought Taekwondo to the US. Bede, I did check. He's not actually related to Philip and Simon Ree.
Damn it. I was just about to look it up too.
Yeah, I did check. But yeah, he's the guy who brought Taekwondo to the US, and he was teaching in the US at the time that this film was made in 1970. And one of the other stars who also only made one other film was a young woman, the first Caucasian woman to be in a Hong Kong martial arts film. Her name is Anne Winton, and she plays Mary. She only ever made one other film, which was a Bruce Exploitation movie. Actually, sadly, she knew Bruce Lee quite well. They were friends, and she used part of her pay from this film to be able to go to his funeral. Winton is terrific in this. Really dynamic martial arts and actually gives a perfectly good performance. Obviously, I watched the Mandarin dub, and obviously she's not doing her own voice work, but the physical performance is terrific. And Unfortunately, like I said, she only made one other film, and there's a very, very sad story about how she ended up. If you want to do some Googling, it's rough. It's a real shame. I wish she'd been in more movies, but I'm definitely going to seek out her Bruceploitation film. Anyway, the main focus of this is Angela Mao, Carter Wong, and Jun Ri, who are kind of the center of this rebellion, trying to protect a list of other people in the group with them. That plot is, as is so often the case, just a framework on which to hang a bunch of really amazing fights, largely choreographed by a then 21-year-old Sammo Hung, who also plays the second string villain with, and this is an absolutely star-packed cast. So you've got Angela Mao, you've got Sammo Hung, you've got Hwang In-sik as the main villain, you've got Carter Wong, as I said. You've got very early, very brief appearances from a 16-year-old Yun Biao. Lam Ching Ying is also in there, who would obviously go on to be stock players in Sammo's company. And it really is a breakout for Sammo. I think we see him in this moving away from the very placed Shaw Brothers style that he was doing and into a much more dynamic, faster-paced, harder-hitting martial arts style that he would refine throughout his career. I think it's masterfully choreographed throughout and really well shot. The camera is also very dynamic in this. There are moments when it sits and lets you just take in a fight, but it gets more involved as well. Huang Feng, who directed it, brings a style that isn't entirely common to it. I think it's terrific. And it also has, in one of the shots of Angela Mao, and if you look her up on my Blue Sky, you'll see this shot. I think one of the coolest images in the history of martial arts cinema.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I watched this for the show. And I got to say, I agree with you, Sam. I think this is a really fun and entertaining martial arts film. And I didn't know what to expect when I sat down and watched it. I just saw the title, When Taekwondo Strikes. I thought, okay, it pretty much lays it thick on the title. So I'm looking forward to sitting down to watch it. And my mind was blown when Sammo Hung showed up in as one of the lead henchmen. And he's really good as well. And that sort of physicality that we know from him is very prevalent in this film. But yeah, it was kind of one of those films, like it really kind of surprised me with its story and just the certain elements I hadn't seen from other martial art films that I'd seen, at least from this period, with Angela Mao Ying just making a great lead. And also Anne Winton, who, again, my mind was blown when she started doing martial arts. And it's like, oh, wow, she's kind of like a precursor to Cynthia Rathrock and many others. And
my friend Tim, looks wise, compared her to Kathleen Byron in Black Narcissus and said it's like, because she is wearing a wimple in a lot of her scenes as well, because she is a nun. And it's like Black Narcissus suddenly kicked a bunch of us.
I love that idea.
I'd watch it. And it's not inaccurate. She does look a little bit like Kathleen Byron. Anyway, B, go ahead.
Yeah, the action set pieces are fantastic. And I love the fact that even at certain points, you could definitely tell they made sure the camera was in a bit more with the action, because you see that camera just move along with the actors as they're doing all these incredible fight scenes. And also the story itself is very compelling. I thought this was a blast.
I agree with what you've both said. I really enjoyed this a lot. I came in for a martial arts film and I got sucked into these characters and the story, and I just found it all very compelling. And I didn't really look up anything before watching the film. So I was like, oh, it's Sammo Hung and I love his hair. And I just thought everyone was fantastic. Angela Mao, again, fantastic lead, but just everything about it is great. I just found a really compelling film, and it's got some incredible martial arts scenes. And again, it's very beautifully shot. It looks really nice. There's a lot of good scenery that they definitely take advantage of. So again, highly recommend this one.
And I guess we'll go into my fourth pick for this episode. And it's a little number from the 80s. And it's a, I guess you could say it's an erotic thriller. And that, of course, would be Ken Russell's Crimes of Passion. I picked this again for Judesploitation. So Judesploitation was a good month for me last year in terms of
I need to actually do Judesploitation this year. I haven't usually done it, but I need to get into doing that.
I think you should definitely do it for sure.
I highly recommend doing it because it makes June so much better.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So going into this, and for those who are not aware of Crimes of Passion, it was directed by Ked Russell. And it is about a woman named Joanne who is a fashion designer, but she leads a double life. So when she is not working as a fashion designer during the day, at night she works as a sex worker named China Blue. She gets the attention of a private detective who is following her, but also a psychotic priest played by Anthony Perkins. And she becomes his obsession. Ken Russell is a filmmaker. I admire Ken Russell a lot, but some of these films can be a little hot and cold for me. Not to say there have been ones that I hated or anything like that. Like, sometimes his style can be a bit mixed for me. Not sure what to expect, but yeah, I would have to say this is probably my favorite Ken Russell film. I just had an absolute ball with this film, and I think Kathleen Turner is fantastic in the lead role. And Anthony Perkins, even though he does channel a little bit of Norman Bates with his performance in this one, but even more psychotic, he's really good as well. And I also love Addie Potts, and who, of course, most people know as Janine from the Ghostbusters series. And she is great as playing the wife of Joanna's love interest in the film. And of course, they have this passionate affair. As you would expect from a Ken Russell film, it really kind of goes with the sexuality. And it is a very sexy movie, but it's also a very dark movie, but also has a lot of dark humor in it as well. And visually, the movie just looks spectacular. Like, this is a beautiful looking film. This was a blind board I did like ages ago when I picked up the Arrow Blu-ray for this film. And because I heard a lot of good things about it, I thought I'll check it out. And yeah, I really love this movie. I was not expecting it to love it as much as I did. So Crimes and Passions was a fantastic watch.
And you're welcome, because I feel like you added it to your Junesploitation because of the After Dark with Super Marcy podcast, where this was discussed as a Ken Russell double feature. So you can naturally go and hear all my thoughts and a very deep dive and dissection on a lot of aspects of the film on that podcast. But just briefly, it's a fantastic film. Visually, it's incredible. The performances are fantastic. One of the things I did highlight on the episode is you sort of compared Anthony Perkins with the Norman Bates performance, but his performance in this as the priest, I feel like there's a massive key difference. Norman Bates is where you feel sympathy for Norman Bates. You don't feel sympathy for this guy.
Yep.
I feel like he's a very irredeemable type of character, and he played it so brilliantly well. But again, Kathleen Turner is fantastic. I think it's one of Ken Russell's masterpieces. But for me, my favorite Ken Russell was probably going to always be The Devils. But Crimes of Passion is fantastic, in my opinion.
Yeah, to sort of jump off what Marcy was saying there, I like Crimes of Passion a lot. It's a great little piece of neon-dipped sleaze. It looks great. Kathleen Turner looks and is fantastic in it. Perkins is appropriately creepy and fucked up. Of what I've seen, other than The Fall of the Louse of Usher, which he shot with a camcorder in his garage, this might be my least favorite Ken Russell, to be honest. And that's not a knock on it. It's a great movie. I just fucking love Ken Russell. Like, Mad Uncle Ken is very much my speed. I love this movie, but I would have it after Gothic, and I would have it after probably Altered States, and I would, you know, have it after The Music Lovers, which was another film that I very nearly put on my list for this show. Great discovery this year. And especially The Devils, which I think is one of the greatest films ever made. Yeah, I mean, this is a really good movie, but it's probably not where I would say people... It's not the most urgent Ken Russell that people should be looking out for me. Please, God, let there be a version of The Devils sometime that is the version we all deserve.
We can only hope that happens one day.
I have seen it uncut twice. I've seen it projected uncut twice. We need that on a 4K disc.
Mm-hmm. Ed, Marcy, what is your fifth and final film?
Okay, so the final film is the one I put as number one. So for me, this was, my favorite discovery of a film released prior to 2024 that I watched for the first time. And that is 1994's Angel Dust and another Japanese film. And just from the get-go, this film it's hypnotic. From start to finish, it just grabs a hold and doesn't let you go. And it's interesting because where the plot goes, it kind of makes a lot of sense, but it's very unnerving. And it's a film that is about serial killings. And what's distinctive about them is they happen on the same day and same time each week. And the victims aren't really connected or they can't find a connection. So they bring in somebody to help them, which is Setsuko Suma, played by Kao Minami, and I apologize if I got names wrong. And she's sort of the person that has a talent getting into the mind of the killer. But as this story goes on, we find out more and more about why she has a connection to this and this strange man called Dr. Rei Aku, played by Takeshi Wakamatsu, and what he has to do with it, which gets really interesting. I just found this was visually very engrossing. Every frame for me has a purpose and doesn't shy away from being ugly. And I've seen comparisons to Silence of the Lambs, and I think, yeah, they could make for an interesting double feature, but I feel like the similarity may be serial killer and female lead. But I just thought it was an intense and compelling story. It goes into themes that I was not expecting, and the performances are just incredible. I thought Kaho Minami and Takeshi Wakamatsu are both incredible, but there's this intense and almost frightening chemistry between the two, and it's almost like you want to look away, but you can't. It's just so engrossing. I honestly was just really blown away by this film. I can't give it enough praise. It's one of those movies that just completely blew me away. And I think every year I have one of those films. And yeah, this year it was this one. And 5 stars.
Well, like I sort of stated before, I love going into some of these films without any prior knowledge. I only just watched it based on your recommendation, Marcy. And throughout all of it, I was just sitting there going like, where is this going? Because I had an idea, like, because I knew it was a serial killer film, so I had that in mind. But where it actually goes with its story, this is another, well, that escalated quickly type of story. But you're right, though, in the sense that it has this sort of very hypnotic tone. I could definitely see what you mean when some people kind of put the comparisons with Silence of the Lambs. So I could definitely see those elements there. But I feel like totally... it feels very similar to Kiroshi Kurosawa's Cure, which had a very similar tone. So watching this film, I was very much reminded of that one. But yeah, this one, though, like, it has so many interesting plot twists. And it's not just one big one. There's like multiple ones. And the performances are great. It's beautifully shot. And yeah, I thought this was a big surprise as well, Marcy. So I appreciate you getting me onto this movie for this show.
You're welcome.
So this has been on my 90s watch list for a while, and I was gonna actually sit down and watch it this morning before we did this, but I was like, actually might be more interesting to listen to Marcy talk about it and then watch it this afternoon. So I think that's probably what I'm gonna do. I'm very much intrigued by and critically serial killer cinema as well. I think there's a lot of great serial killer cinema out there. It's a sort of substrata of horror. Henry, the Black Panther, particularly come to mind. Hounds of Love, more recently. So, yeah, I'm very much up for this. The only thing that slightly concerns me now that I've heard big talk is the comparison to Kiyoshi Kurosawa, who I don't get it, man. The stuff that I've seen from him, like everyone bangs on about Pulse, but no, it didn't do anything for me, I'm afraid.
Oh, but those are fighting words for Marcy.
But this isn't in that sort of ghost story mold, which I really don't like Japanese ghost cinema very much. Though I'm about to go on a podcast on Japan on Film to record my third episode with them, which will be on a ghost movie, which I do very much like. So, and that's going to be way in the future, but look out for that as and when. But yeah, I'm intrigued. As I say, it's been on my list for ages, so I will probably watch this afternoon or certainly by the end of the week, I would think.
Yeah, I'll be waiting. And if you don't like it, I will accept that and move on.
Yeah, that sounds like you.
And Sam, what is your...
I can only say that because we've known each other like 20 years at this point.
Sam, what is your fifth and final film?
Yeah, I think this ties in quite interestingly to what Marcy was just talking about, because mine is also a Japanese film and sort of carrying on that theme. But also, so far, I've largely talked about martial arts. I've talked about exploitation. I've talked about one of the most fucked up movies I've ever seen in terms of Singapore Sling. And what I've ended up with as my favorite discovery of 2024, the most quiet, reflective, meditative film I probably saw the entire year of everything I saw, old, new, rewatch, new to me. And that's a film called We'll Keep Walking, That's All. I saw it purely because at the beginning of last year, and I would encourage anyone to do this, I decided to do a project and watch as many of Sakura Ando's films as I could, the Japanese actress Sakura Ando, who many people, I suspect, listening to this will know as the young cult leader in Love Exposure, or more recently, the neighbor in Godzilla Minus One. And in this, she plays a photographer, a sort of early to mid-20s photographer named Miyuki. And her boyfriend is moving to New York, and they're breaking up purely because of that. And it's not because they don't want to be together anymore, but he's moving and it's just not going to work out as a long distance thing. And we see a bit of that in flashback and a bit of the aftermath of that breakup in flashback. But most of the film is her having had this breakup go on for a little while, going back home to the tiny village that she moved to Tokyo from, and just walking around, taking pictures, and meeting up with a few of her friends from school, most notably one who's become a teacher at their school, and eventually taking portraits of some of her old friends. And that's the entire film, and it's only 73 minutes long. A lot of it is just the director, Ryuichi Hiroki, following Ando from a distance as she walks around this village and takes pictures of mundane things and people. Eventually, she meets the teenage girl who now sleeps in the bedroom that she slept in as a teenager, and they talk a bit. And this girl, as Ando is photographing her while she walks to school, she says it's like meeting my future self, and there's some lovely stuff in that. The whole film for me is about memory, about nostalgia, and about the way that Miyuki's camera is kind of a focal point and a filter for those things. I think initially we see it as a shield that she's using to block out her heartache, But then it kind of becomes a window again as she reconnects with some people and learns about other losses in her and her friends' lives. It's really a great film, not quite a coming of age film, but a great movie about growing up and learning to accept that you're in a new stage of your life. Ando is absolutely incredible in it, largely silent, but brilliant when she has dialogue. I think there's an amazing moment in it when, not long after the breakup, a waiter at her favorite restaurant asks her out, and just the pain of having to try and let him down easy, even though she doesn't want to let him down easy, because it's just exactly what she doesn't need in that moment, is just, it's all over her face. It's so complex what she's doing. And I think that's kind of a trademark of performances, that level of complexity. I think it's a brilliant film, and just, she's so incredible in it. And tiny biographical note, this was shot in about 2009, not long after Ando had got together with Tatsuko Emoto, who would become her husband, father of her daughter. He plays her ex-boyfriend at the beginning of the film. So it's this lovely thing of these two people in real life are just beginning to fall in love, and now they're playing this couple in love who can't be together anymore. It adds just a lovely extra layer to that, I find.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. Well, yeah, I agree with everything. I really love this a lot. And I just feel like I could watch Sakura Ando just walk around, take pictures, and have a bit of self-discovery for hours. I was just very engrossed with just watching her take these pictures and have this kind of self-discovery almost. It's a different point in your life, and it's like accepting that and having nostalgia about things. But I found all of it just really real. I was intrigued. I was glued to the screen. And I think those last like 15 minutes where she's taking photos, I absolutely loved how that all kind of came together. I just, yeah, really, really enjoyed this one a lot. I got a lot out of it. And I too think I may need to watch more Sakura Ando films now.
She's just the best actor working today, I think, in her age group, certainly. I just think she's astonishing. And as you said, I would watch her just read the phone book for hours. I just think she's incredible and has the most interesting face. Like,
yeah, I wasn't that big on this film, and I feel bad for that, especially after hearing you both talk about it. But honestly, again, this was another one where I just went in, didn't read anything, and I have to admit, and I feel really bad about knowing this, I honestly didn't realize that that was meant to be the main character's boyfriend. I thought it was her brother.
My dude, how could you make that mistake? It's really very clear.
I thought it was her brother, and I thought that's why she was sad, because her brother was moved away to New York. That's why I thought she was sad, and it wasn't until I read the plot summary, it's like, oh, that was her boyfriend. But I'm like, oh, wow, I guess that's probably why the movie didn't work for me, because I just wasn't that engaged by it. Sakura Ando, I think, is pretty good in the film. I think she does have a great presence about her. But I feel like for this film, I just couldn't really emotionally connect with her journey and her dealing with this breakup and coming back to this small town and just meeting all the people that she knew. It just didn't really connect to me on an emotional level. I tried to figure out why that is. And I guess for me, like, I do love low-key films, but I feel like this might have been a little too low-key and a bit repetitive as well. It just didn't really hook it in for me as a story. It is well-made. And like I said, Sakura Ando is really good and the supporting cast are all really solid. And there's some really lovely moments sprinkled throughout it. But I kind of felt like even at 74 minutes, it kind of just dragged in spots as well. And I feel really bad about that.
You should feel really bad. Oh, I would have loved another half hour of this film.
I don't know that I agree with that. I think it is a good length. It is slight.
I was very pleased and fascinated by Sakura Ando taking photos. So I could have just watched an extra half hour of that, to be honest, without any other development.
Yeah, there's that lovely sequence where in the flashback she's taking photos of that band. I think is really great. I would love to see, because she's obviously actually taking photos throughout, I would love to see if there's like an album of the pictures that she took for this movie. I think that would be really interesting to sort of find out how good a photographer she actually became for it. I think that would be intriguing.
Definitely.
Because I think the pictures at the end are clearly not taken by her, because the last sort of 15 minutes, she's actually off screen a lot of that time. Mm. And you're seeing through her camera's lens and just hearing her. So I think it's unlikely that she took those pictures, but obviously there are a lot of pictures that were taken during the shooting by her. Mm. So yeah, that would be intriguing.
Well, I guess I'll move on to my fifth and final film for this episode. And I want to talk about a very fun topic, racism.
Great.
So, which is the perfect way to end this episode on. So,
yeah, the perfect way to end this episode that has been so much about international film.
Indeed, indeed. So for my fifth and final film, I want to talk about, and this to me was the best discovery that I made last year, and that of course is the 1962 film The Intruder, which was directed by Roger Corman. And one of the reasons why I watched it was because Roger Corman, one of our great filmmakers who opened the door for so many filmmakers out there, passed away last year. And I watched this as part of Junesploitation, because one of the things they sort of did with Junesploitation last year was the very first prompt they did on day one was watch a Roger Corman film. But it wasn't just that. Every couple of prompts, there was something that had something to do with Roger Corman, whether it be different periods of his filmmaking career, whether it be the different studios that he produced. And that was why Crimes of Passion was on my list for Junesploitation. I mean, other than Marcy's recommendation, I also included it because it was distributed by one of Roger Corman's production companies as well. So that's why it was on the list. I thought I want to pick something out of the box in terms of a Roger Corman film for that first day. So I picked The Intruder because I'd heard a lot of interesting things about it. So for those out there who have never heard of this film, it's sort of set in a small town. And one day, a man by the name of Adam Kramer, played by William Shatner, arrives. He comes to this town and incites all the white townspeople to be racist towards the black population of this town. Everyone beforehand is just living their lives, just carefree and no problems whatsoever. But he just sort of comes in and starts stirring the pot and starts to incite this racial tension with everyone in this town. William Shatner in this film, he plays this character so incredibly well. He is an evil character. And it's kind of interesting watching this film. Like, this film is still very relevant today. I mean, we're seeing this type of thing even just as we're talking about, as we're recording this episode, we're still seeing this type of stuff now. And this character could easily be seen as a Ben Shapiro or a Tucker Carlson. But instead of just being on a TV show and spouting all this garbage, he's literally going from town to town and starting up all this racial tension that was never there to begin with. Or, well, maybe
it was there because this is set where they were trying to end segregation. So
yeah,
they were having schools be unsegregated. He comes in at the opportune time where things are changing and towns are going through the change where they are going to integrate people of
And that's still what they're doing now. That's the playbook of these fuckers. So that hasn't changed.
Well, purposely inciting them because this is happening, because he knows that he can, because people with change get scared and want answers and blah blah blah. And like, you watch the film and he overtakes this town with this like mass hysteria essentially very quickly, and you sort of think, oh no, it couldn't be that quick. But no, we've seen it in real time. It is that quick. So But I just wanted to point it out. He's not just doing it for no reason. It's because they were trying to end segregation and that the school was going to be... There's a term for it. I can't think of the right name. Desegregated? Is it desegregation? Yeah.
Mm. Well, I was going to say that.
or indeed integrated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention that as well. So, yeah, it's just like it's a mixture of that and stuff that's already there. And then, of course, he comes in and just makes it much worse. And it is a very raw film. It is very unflinching on how it portrays racism. William Shatner, like, I mean, say what you will about William Shatner, but I thought he was amazing in this film.
I think, like, hands down, it is one of his best performances.
I would even argue it's probably his best performance.
And to think this is before being on Star Trek, and that it was quite campy. It was a campy show, but he's just on another level, and it's almost a little frightening just how well he does it.
Yeah, I'm not a Trek person, so I've never really... There are individual films I like, but I've never thought it was a particularly a great showcase for great acting in any incarnation. It would be interesting to see if Shatner, had he not been on Trek, have given more performances that are more nuanced like this. It's an open question. It's an interesting one. I think this is a very good film. Yeah.
I do want to add that after seeing Shatner's performance in this, it makes sense why they would use his face to be the mask of Michael Myers.
But I think the main thing to say about this, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, I'm sure. I think Corman is less by virtue of the films he made than the films he shepherded, the most important figure in American cinema in the last 60 years. I don't even know that it's up for debate. There's an entire generation of filmmakers that wouldn't exist in the same way without Roger Corman. And they're the filmmakers, the whole movie brat generation, with, I think, the exception of Spielberg, worked for him at some point. So it's crazy. But yeah, he's one of the greats. This is maybe not his best film, but I like it very much. Yeah, I think of what I've seen of his directorial work, I think Mask of the Red Death is probably the best of them. But this is also really interesting, really sadly still thought-provoking and relevant film. I find myself watching a lot of political cinema from days gone by these days. And there's a reason, as we're recording this, that TCM yesterday programmed an entire day of, like, Fuck the Nazis movies. We're recording this just a couple of days after Trump's re-inauguration, for anyone who is interested in the timeline aspect there. So there's a whole lot of movies that are becoming relevant again in a way that they didn't feel contemporarily relevant for a while. This is one of them, I think. And of course, you can extrapolate the way this engages and the people in this engage with race to the way that transgender issues are being engaged with now. And I think it's still 60 plus years on, a very instructive movie, and it fucking shouldn't be.
Agreed. And I think also too, it has a really great screenplay from Charles Beaumont, and it's actually based on his own novel as well, and kind of looking into Charles Beaumont, because I was very curious. Marcy, he wrote many episodes of The Twilight Zone, including Living Doll, which we discussed on Podcasters of Horror.
Of course. Yes. Yeah, no, I agree. It's an important film. It's a very strong film. Again, like, the Shatner performance is the performance of the film. And yeah, it can be instructive on how to be a William Shatner type character. We see him engaging with KKK behavior, cross burning, really awful stuff. Like, there is a point where he is framing a young man that's at the school for doing something that he did not do. It's like a setup. And this is sort of where the townsfolk kind of come to the realization that they've been had. And it's a kind of realization that I really want a lot of people in this world to have over their just disgusting and hateful views. This film really points out the utter stupidity that is racism, but it points out the utter stupidity of being angry just because somebody is slightly different than you. We need peace and harmony more than ever, and we should be loving our differences, not fighting about the most ridiculous crap. So that's my TED talk. Racism is bad. Being a dickhead is bad. Having hateful, bigoted feelings is just
bad. I'm sure
that
most people who listen to this show are cool. But if anyone wants to come at us for getting political on a podcast about movies, watch movies better. Art is inherently political, whether because of something it is inherently saying or because of how it is interpreted. And those things shift over time. So learn to watch movies better and interpret what is being served up to you rather than just watching it passively. There's nothing wrong with passively watching something from time to time. It's fine. I'm not going to say that when you watch fucking Bloodsport next, you have to really delve into the political intricacies of everything that's going on in it. You can probably find them, is my point, one way or another. And I just feel like you can look for these things, and when they're interpreted, you might disagree with what we're finding in certain movies. We haven't really touched massively on the politics of all of these films. They are there, whether you like it or not. And it's worth engaging with from time to time, particularly in the sort of fucking reality that we find ourselves in now, I think.
Agreed. Well, I guess that could be a wrap for this episode of the Super Podcast. Ed, thank you, Marcy, for being a very awesome co-host, as per usual.
You're welcome. And I'd like to thank you both for the films that you've provided on this podcast, because the ones I had not seen have all made my 2025 first viewings top list. So
yeah, we're just going to have to make sure that we don't double up on next year's show, because I think we should do this as a running thing now.
This is so
much more interesting than just going, like you were saying at the beginning, than just going, here's my top 10 of 2024. It's reshuffled from the 50 films that other people have talked about so far. Fuck that. This is much more fun.
Well, I definitely have. I mean, we're 3 weeks into January and I've watched 62 films, so I think I will have some good options.
Jesus, you're even ahead of me. Wow. I thought I was doing well with 43. Jeez.
But before we wrap up the show today, Marcy, where can people find you and also all things to the Super Podcast out there on the internet this week?
Yeah, head to supermarcy.com. And you can find this show as well as all of our other podcasts there. And you can find a handy link for the Super Network socials and podcasts at our link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. And on the social medias, I am Super Marcy. However, on Letterboxd, where you should definitely follow me, I am super_Marcy. And you can go and check out like the 30 movies that are already on my best of, no, not my best of, my favorite, what's my list called? For my 2025 discoveries list. There we go. Struggled through that a bit.
And Sam, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yeah, well, other than on Beat and Sam versus the Video Nasties, which I'm sure you'll plug a bit more substantially as well, I can be found on Blue Sky at 24fps UK, which is also my Letterboxd handle, so follow me there. For I have been very good this year. I've reviewed everything I've seen so far on Letterboxd, and I'm doing my level best to keep it up. I've got some interesting projects going on there, some lists that I'm putting out each day at the moment, so it's a fun time. And you can also listen to my other podcast, Fearless Pretender. You can look us up on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, that sort of thing. And that is a filmography podcast about the great Jennifer Jason Leigh. And as we release this, I have just had my second episode Japan on film release, which is on Shinji Sumai's Typhoon Club. And I have an upcoming episode in a couple of weeks talking Japanese culture, the podcast Pick a Disc, where I will be discussing Bandmaid's album Just Bring It.
And if people want to find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can also find my work over at supermarcy.com. And also you can listen to my solo shows, Bede versus the Living Dead, Bede and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, Bede and Steve versus Leatherface, and as well as mine and Sam's show together, Bede and Sam versus the Video Nazis, on all podcast streamers everywhere, either on their own solo feeds or as part of the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed on all podcast streamers everywhere. So, yep, that is a wrap for this episode of the Super Podcast. And we'll see you all next time, everybody. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Really matters when you're standing.